from deep inside your radio.
All right, it's a softening job market, ladies and gentlemen. Although there are major opportunities if you're, if you're an immigrant down in down Louisiana way. But there are jobs elsewhere. Dateline Dubai. Al-Qaeda has put job advertisements on the internet asking for people to help put together its internet statements and video montages. This according to an Arabic newspaper quoted by Reuters. The London-based Ashark Al-Aswa... London-based newspaper, Arabic newspaper, said on its website this week that Al-Qaeda had vacant positions for video production and editing for statements, footage, and international media coverage about militants in Iraq, the Palestinian territories, Chechnya, and other conflict zones where militants are active. The paper said the Global Islamic Media Front, an Al-Qaeda-linked organization, would follow up with members interested in joining and contact them by email. The paper did not say how applicants should contact the Global Islamic Media Front.
We'll find you. Don't worry about it.
Al-Qaeda supporters widely use the internet to spread the group's statement through dozens of Islamist sites. The advertisements could not be found on mainstream Islamist websites where Al-Qaeda and other affiliate groups post their statements. The newspaper said the advertisement did not specify salary, but added, quote, every Muslim knows his life is not his, since it belongs to this violated Islamic nation. I guess that means minimum wage. Are you kidding, brother? The front last month launched an internet news broadcast called The Voice of the Caliphate, which it said aimed to combat anti-Al-Qaeda lies and propaganda, quote-unquote, on channels such as CNN and Al Jazeera. See, Al-Qaeda doesn't like Al Jazeera either. Al-Qaeda and other groups have increasingly turned to the internet. So, job opportunity, but no real idea how to apply. That's so like the terrorists. Hello, welcome to the show.
Your loving kindness. kindness and all your tenderness. I said all your tenderness. Yeah. Oh, lady, you made me so very happy. Even the blind man could see that love can be so beautiful. Love that's made. Love is found its way in our hearts today. Love is found its way in our hearts today. In our hearts today.
And the night and the music fill me with flaming desire, setting my being completely on fire. You and the night and the music thrill me, but will we be one after the night and the music are done? Until the pale light of dawn and in daylight, hearts will be throbbing guitars. Morning will come without warning and take away the stars. If we must live for the moment, love till the moment is through. After the night and the music die, well, I have you. stars. Morning will come without warning and take away the stars. If we must live for the moment, love till the moment is through. After the night and the music dying, well, I have you.
Thank you very much, Radio VIP singers. I'm the VIP in Radio VIP. I'm Harry Shearer from the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, welcoming you to the show. Yes, we've upped the production values. Thanks for your contribution. Ladies and gentlemen, cannabis, known in this country as marijuana, the third most popular recreational drug after alcohol and tobacco, this week won an unlikely accolade from scientists. It's junk science, who said that it could boost brain power. This is your brain on drugs. Yeah, they were right, except they were wrong. Experiments on rats given a potent cannabinoid, and that's a substance, not a person, have shown the drug stimulates the growth of new brain cells. That's just the opposite of what we were told, that's all. Just a 180. Canadian researchers found that the drug caused neurons to regenerate in the hippocampus. You know where we used to have the rallies? No, it's an area that controls mood and emotions after 1 month of treatment. Its effect was similar to that of the antidepressant drug Prozac, which is only a lot more expensive, which also stimulates nerve growth in the hippocampus. The rats treated with the marijuana were less anxious and more willing to eat in a novel environment that would normally make them fearful. Yeah, this McDonald's isn't so bad after all. Ladies and gentlemen, your brain on drugs revised. And now, yes, right up here at the top of the program, I'm going to read the trades for you. This is from Manufacturing and Technology News. Political appointees rewrite Commerce Department report on outsourcing. Ooh, this hot stuff. I'm going to read it for you. The Commerce Department of the United States government has responded to a half-year-old request by Manufacturing and Technology News for the release of a long-awaited study on the issue of offshore outsourcing of internet technology, service sector jobs, and high-tech industries. But the 12-page document, represented by the agency as its final report, is not what was written by its analysts. Rather, according to those familiar with it, it was crafted by political appointees at the Commerce Department and the White House. Imagine that. That's me interpolating. At an estimated cost of $335,000, or $28,000 per page, the document Manufacturing Technology News received from the Commerce Department contains no original research and forsakes its initial intent of providing a balanced view of outsourcing, according to those inside and outside the agency. That would appear to be everywhere. The report was requested by Congress in December 2003 with a six-month deadline. A 12-page version was released September 8th of this year as a result of the Freedom of Information request by Manufacturing and Technology News. According to those who have tracked the report's whereabouts, it was completed well before the November 2004 election, but was delayed for clearance by the White House and Congress due to the controversial nature of the subject, outsourcing. After the November election, a draft of the report, prepared by a brain trust of analysts, went into a vetting process among political appointees at the Commerce Department of the White House. It never resurfaced. vetting as in drowning or drowning. Just me interpolating again. The analysts never received any feedback on their work, which is unusual, say those who have written similar reports. The 12-page version that was released focuses on the allegedly positive impacts for the U.S. economy of the offshore outsourcing of jobs in the information technology, semiconductor, and pharmaceutical industries, argue those who have read it. The report quotes research conducted by organizations and individuals that have been funded by multinationals that benefit from shifting jobs overseas. No mention is made of that conflict of interest in the studies cited by the report. Manufacturing and Technology News requested an interview with Ben Wu, the Commerce Department's Assistant Secretary for Technology Policy, seeking information on why the published version bears little resemblance to the one prepared by the analysts. The interview request was not fulfilled. No Wu. Wu no can do. The final report says the government data can offer only very limited insight into the extent and impact of workforce globalization, and that it was not possible to determine whether the shift of U.S. work to non-U.S. locations resulted in job losses for U.S. workers. Two technology administration analysts involved in writing the information technology and software section of the report made a public presentation in December describing their findings, offering a detailed analysis of the trend, including charts on the growth of Indian outsourcing firms, and describing the jobs that will likely remain in the United States, noting that most overseas IT companies don't do research. They noted in their report that venture capitalists are encouraging IT startup firms to use offshore software developers to reduce their outflow of cash, and that there is growing pressure in corporate America to offshore information technology work, unquote. Little of that analytical work made it into the final Commerce Department report. Says outsourcing expert Professor Ronil Hira of the Rochester Institute of Technology, quote, there is nothing in here that is original research. It's not a balanced or an objective study of what's happening and what the implications are. It's missing a lot of information that was available at the time. It's equivalent of the work of a sophomore at the college where I teach. Martin Kenny, a professor at the University of California, Davis, and a member of a panel investigating the issue of outsourcing, concurs, quote, it's a little bit shocking that that level of work could come out of anybody with a college education, he says. I mean, I wouldn't accept that from my students in a class. Unquote. The report states the Commerce Department was not able to, quote, perform detailed empirical estimation of the outsourcing trend, because it's just the Commerce Department. Says Martin Kenny at UC Davis, the U.S. government is different from most other countries because most other countries are taking this very seriously and are trying to think through where this global shift of services and mental labor is going to be located in the next 20 years. The United States seems to be treating this even more cavalierly than it treated the relocation of manufacturing. To ignore what's happening won't mean it won't happen, but on the other hand, It will prevent you from having to do anything, says Kenny. It's pretty amazing, he concludes, that the government would put out something like that report. Unquote. Shows you how easily amazed some people are, ladies and gentlemen. A new discovery every time I read the trades for you, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Or it joins a growing list of phenomena I describe as amazing, but not surprising. That's probably where it belongs. Now, some news from outside the bubble. You may have seen news this week of a letter that the United States claimed was sent from an Al-Qaeda leader to Iraq insurgency leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. You probably saw that. You may not have seen the interesting follow-up. U.S. intelligence officials who released that letter said on Friday they could not account for a passage that has raised doubts about the document's authenticity. The letter dated July 9th, which U.S. officials say was written by al-Qaeda's second-in-command, Ayman al-Zawahiri, appears near its close to urge Zarqawi, the Iraqi insurgent leader, to send greetings to himself if he visits Fallujah. Spokesman for John Negroponte, head of U.S. Director of National Intelligence, acknowledged the greetings passage was confusing, but said the intelligence community was confident the letter was addressed to Zarqawi by Zawahiri. "We don't know what to make of that passage. It's unclear," Negroponte's spokesman said, "but we're absolutely confident it was intended for Mr. Zarqawi." U.S. officials have refused to disclose details of where, when, or how authorities came by the letter or what methods have been used to determine its authenticity. Some experts contend the strange passage undermines the letter's credibility. This would appear to be the conclusive evidence that DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, was mistaken. The letter was written to someone other than Zarqawi, said Stephen Aftergood of the Federation of American Scientists. Experts have already said the letter depicts Zawahiri as making unrealistic admissions involving al-Qaeda's need for money. The greetings passage gained little notice from initial news coverage. Please send my greetings to you if you... Here's the exact words. "Especially, by God, if by chance you're going to Fallujah, send greetings to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi," says a letter that supposedly is addressed to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. You see, ladies and gentlemen, please send greetings to yourself. Why wouldn't you believe that? Dateline London, Maggie Thatcher, remember her? She's criticized Tony Blair, nothing new there, but wait, for taking Britain to war in Iraq on the basis of flawed evidence about Saddam Hussein's weapons. Maggie Thatcher now weighs in on that. Former Prime Minister's embarrassing criticism emerged as Blair was among the 670 guests who attended Thatcher's 80th birthday party. She is a strong supporter of the decision to topple Saddam by invading Iraq, but it's the first time she questioned the basis for the war. Well, that's a coherent way of thinking, isn't it? When asked whether she would have invaded Iraq given the intelligence at the time, Lady Thatcher replied to the Washington Post, "I was a scientist before I was a politician, and as a scientist I know you need facts, evidence, and proof, and then you check, recheck, and check again. The fact was there were no facts, there was no evidence, and there was no proof." Still quoting Maggie Thatcher, "As a politician, the most serious decision you can take is to commit your armed services to war from which they may not return." Thatcher's office did not dispute her reported remarks, but said she was in full support of the decision to oust Saddam. She said, aides said she wished that had been achieved by the first Gulf War. Meaning by Bush 1. No facts, no proof. Maggie Thatcher, ladies and gentlemen. Why does she hate America? This from the Glasgow Sunday Herald. If there are two men in the world who know, this is a story that's been around here and has now been dispatched with. So it's revived again outside the bubble this week by this Scottish newspaper, which does a full report about extraordinary rendition. This is the process by which the United States sweeps up folks that we think might be involved in nefarious activities and spirits them away by air to countries such as Egypt and others, where interesting forms of interrogation are practiced. If there are two men in the world who know about extraordinary renditions, they are Michael Scheuer, the CIA chief who invented the program, and Craig Murray, the United Kingdom ambassador to Uzbekistan, who saw firsthand the devastating consequences for British intelligence of using renditions. In the interviews with this Scottish newspaper, they say the U.S. government deliberately refused to opt for a legal alternative to renditions, which was presented to the president by the CIA, and that the program of extraordinary renditions undermines Western democracy, damages the prosecution of the war, and contaminates British and U.S. intelligence. Aside from that, it's a good idea. Extraordinary rendition, ladies and gentlemen. If it was ordinary, it wouldn't be in the news. Now, news of Rupert Murdoch, because he's Rupert Murdoch. He and his wife, Wendy Deng, have given an interview to the New York Times. This is weird because Rupert Murdoch owns the New York Post. If he wanted ink, he owns it. He buys it by the tubful. But there's a reason. They got a joint to sell. Rupert Murdoch and his wife, his third wife, Wendy Deng, are trying to unload their Soho triplex loft for $28 million, which would make it the most expensive residence ever sold below 14th Street in Manhattan. That's so they can move to a Fifth Avenue penthouse previously owned by Lawrence Rockefeller, for which Rupert has paid $44 million, the most expensive residence ever sold in Manhattan above 14th Street. Yeah, he's got to be miserly with his employees. He's got a mouth to feed. It's called the real estate market. Only six prospective buyers have come to see Rupert's Soho apartment since it was quietly put on the market in June. No one has made an offer. Hence, the dual interviews by Ms. Deng and Mr. Murdoch in the New York Times. We're trying to simplify our life, Ms. Deng said, down to six homes from seven. Ms. Deng said they'd spared no expense, nice to know, in renovating the apartment, spending more on the upgrades than they did on the apartment itself, a 9,300 square foot space on the top three floors of a former candy factory.
Candy.
The couple chose a French interior designer. They've got a fully outfitted gym and a large screening room. Everything was expensively done, said Ms. Deng, because we thought we would be here forever. We were never looking for an apartment until the Rockefeller apartment came on the market. When you see a $44 million apartment, you gotta go for it. I know the feeling. In the living room, they've got low-lying bookcases to leave large expanses of white wall space where Murdoch could hang his prized collection of Australian art, including paintings by his favorite painter, Fred Williams. Ooh, I gotta look him up. That's gotta make his price rise. Ms. Deng said that Russell Crowe had attended a barbecue on the roof. Murdoch noted that Ariel Sharon, the Israeli prime minister, had dinner at the custom-designed table. That should get people to want to make an offer, shouldn't it? The actor Hugh Jackman's children often came over for playdates with the Murdoch's preschool-age daughters. I'm liking what I'm hearing. The budget even included the hiring of a feng shui master from London, Ms. Deng said. It doesn't hurt, she said. It's like chicken soup. No, she's Chinese. The feng shui master had advised the couple to move the stove, which at the time was directly under the spot where they wanted to put their bed. Yes, it does, apparently. Despite their considerable investment, Murdoch said he was not concerned about the softening real estate market. We're not in a hurry, Murdoch said. Three brokers who asked not to be named said they thought the $28 million price tag seemed high for a downtown apartment with a manually operated elevator and no doorman. But Murdoch is determined to sell. We don't need two apartments, he said. You don't need any of it, darling. And by darling, I mean sir. And other news about Rupert Murdoch, Dateline Rome. He says he does not plan to take sides in the forthcoming Italian elections, even though he owns the leading television satellite channel in Italy, Sky Italia. He has held political sway in elections around the world through the newspapers owned by his News Corp. Italian hackles were raised when he met top politicians this week. He said he could have taken a position on Italian politics if he owned newspapers in the country, but he said that television serves a different purpose. Quote, "We are fair and balanced in our reporting of all parties and all politicians," unquote, Murdoch told reporters in Rome. Quote, "I believe that in TV, one is using a public license to disseminate the news, and it is important that you should remain absolutely fair. If I were publishing a newspaper or magazine here, I would consider that quite differently," he added. Unquote. I see. If only he had a TV channel, he'd be fair and balanced. Let me see if I can work on that.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice by the fire, while the breeze on high sang a lullaby. You'd be all that I could desire, under stars chilled by the winter, under an August moon burning above. You'd be so nice, you'd be paradise to come home to and love. You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be awful nice by the fire, while the breeze up on high sang a lullaby. You'd be all that I could desire, under stars chilled by the winter, under an August moon burning up there above. You'd be so nice, just like paradise, to come home to and love.
Yummy. This is Le Show. From the Washington Post, on September 25, White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan defended the tumultuous evacuation of 3 million Texans from Hurricane Rita. Quote, "This was an unprecedented number of people who were being evacuated," he said. In fact, says the Post, the evacuation was the largest in U.S. history since 1999. Hurricane Floyd that year prompted the headlong flight of more than 3 million people from coastal Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas. The result, summarized in a more than 200-page report by FEMA and the Army Corps of Engineers, I salute you, Army Corps of Engineers, foreshadowed the anarchy on freeways leading away from Houston last month. 18-hour traffic jams outside Charleston, South Carolina, complaints that highways were not quickly converted into one-way exit routes, and shortages of supplies for thousands of evacuees, for hundreds of thousands of evacuees. The repeated cycle of calamity response and criticism highlights a persistent flaw, says the paper, in the nation's disaster preparedness 4 years after 9/11, the inability of emergency agencies to learn from past mistakes, even those committed in recent years. We're supposed to learn? I thought we were just supposed to do something else. Humans, the learning animal. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, this week it became big news, unlike the White House spy story, which has disappeared from the media. It became big news that the White House staged an event. Unlike those town meetings the president had all last year. Yeah, those were spontaneous. Those were as spontaneous as Survivor. For some reason, maybe the fact that the president's popularity is now at 38%, the news media found it a big story that a presidential teleconference with a bunch of soldiers in Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown. Hello, Tikrit. That teleconference was rehearsed, that soldiers were walked through their paces, given the questions the president would ask, asked for the answers they would give before the event occurred. Imagine the shock. And imagine the phone call. Oh, you don't have to.
Yellow.
Hey, 4-1.
43.
Yeah.
Hey, David Souter might not be looking so bad right
now. Yeah, hold that thoughtification, will you? Here's Brian.
Brian.
Hello, Mr. President 41.
Brian, have we talked before?
No, sir. I'm Andy Card's executive assistant.
That's swell. It's very swell. Well, now, where's the president? Recall, he's the one who called.
Yes, sir. He'll be positioned to resume the conversation as soon as we nail down the basic outlines of the call. Just for semi-technical purposes.
Nailed down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Brian, hate to burst your pretty balloon, but President Bush called me, so...
Yes, sir. And he'll be operating from a pre-engineered conversational palette. And we just wanted to be up to speed with what is included on that palette, and as well as what may, or for that matter, is not.
I really feel perfectly able to...
Oh, yes, sir, I'm sure you are.
Yeah.
Now, the president will be prepared to answer your questions relative to the Harriet Myers nomination.
Good, because tell you what, Brian, got a few. Good Lord, she couldn't be in more doo-doo if she bought Diet Coke cans just to look for the pubic hairs on top.
Yes, sir, that comment won't be included in your menu of responses.
It won't.
No, sir. He'll be looking to answer your questions as opposed to entertaining your comments just for this specific call. Would you like to try a walkthrough?
Yes, so, although... Mm. All right. And you'll be 43?
Mm-hmm. Just for the purposes of this dry run, yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. And my son himself will be doing the wet run?
We'll just start the conversation, sir.
All right. Hey, 43, how's the nominee holding up?
Oh, incredibly strong, 41. People are going to be amazed by her strength when she ascendifies to the benchship.
The benchship?
Mm-hmm.
You mean you folks are actually writing his malapropositions?
Oh, no, sir, that would be presumptuous. We merely pencil in a range of likely behaviors for the president to choose from.
Oh, gotcha. So, 43, a little surprised that your base is so unbasic on this nomination.
Mm-hmm.
Is that him reacting or you, Brian?
It's just either of us waiting for you to ask a question.
Right. So, 43, mm-hmm. What can you do to get your conservative brethren back in harness, you think?
41, they just have to trust me on this. If they weren't prepared to trust me in situations where the facts, as reported by the newspapers that I don't bother reading, seem to be against us, then they wouldn't have supported the war. So it's a little late now.
He's going to say that?
Something like that, yes. It's included in his preferred response list.
No, what's going on here? This is Karl Rove having kidney and grand jury problems. Andy Card's running the show. Isn't it?
Excuse me, sir. Are you asking the president that question?
Asking you.
Oh, that's what I thought. I'm really not on this call to offer personal reflections, Mr. President, just to do some basic parameter setting for your dialogue sequence with your son.
Appreciate that. Do you have any lines for me, per se?
Oh, no, sir. At the meeting this morning, the consensus was that within the guidelines, you're fully capable of winging it.
Haven't been so flattered since Saddam tried to have me killed. All right, look, Brian.
Stand by for the president in 5 minutes.
Tell him to call me later. Bars give me the evil eye. We're late for dinner at the Mossbackers.
That's going to require a temporal rescheduling.
Just tell me this, Brian. Did I pass the audition?
You did very well, sir.
Thanks. Tell 43 to take care.
Well, passing messages on to the president is not in my portfolio, sir, but I will endeavor to...
When you're dancing on your grave.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week. Yes, they're back.
We're so sorry.
Dateline, Alabama. Former Governor John Siegelman apologized for saying that Lieutenant Governor Lucy Baxley could lose support in the governor's race because of what some believe is a poor response to Hurricane Katrina by Louisiana's female governor. If anybody took offense to my comments, especially Mrs. Baxley, I apologize, Siegelman told the newspaper. I love Lucy like everybody else. And if I offended her, I apologize. National Public Radio apologizes to the Paris Review and Philip Gurevich for a story on their website. In the piece, we failed to allow Mr. Gurevich any opportunity to answer former editors who questioned his stewardship of the magazine, The Paris Review. In fact, the new Paris Review includes 6 items that, in the view of NPR, uphold the vision of the literary magazine's founder, George Plimpton. As opposed to what is suggested by the review on the website. After 13 years at WSMV, Channel 4 Nashville, James Lewis has resigned following a piece in which he reported that cops arrested a McDonald's employee for selling a Big Mac to a prostitute, thus violating a law against giving nutrition to a prostitute. He said, live follow-up to a pre-recorded piece, he said, they busted her because it's against the law to give nutrition to a prostitute. Anchor Dan Miller, surprised. James, a little more on that. What kind of crime is that to provide food to a police decoy? Is it actually a crime? It was, according to the weekly Fabricator column in a local magazine, which is where Lewis got the information. The Fabricator is a satirical column. Reported the McDonald's bit. In researching his piece, Lewis did a Google search that returned that humorous piece. What James did was make a terrible mistake of emphasizing something that was clearly not true, says news director. What's his first name here? I'll find it. It's not in the story. Oh, yes, Andrew Finlayson. Not James Finlayson. Finlayson says Lewis quickly apologized to the staff and anchors. And one of the anchors subsequently read an on-air apology about the erroneous report. In the end, an embarrassed Lewis resigned. Leaders of a parent-teacher-student association-sponsored magazine drive at a middle school in Fairfield, Connecticut. And school administrators apologized last week for sending home a women's magazine featuring some adult content. The publication More is a lifestyle and health magazine geared toward middle-aged women and was intended to be a gift for parents. The issue sent home with students included articles on anti-aging products, mental and physical wellness, and a feature on Jodie Foster, but it also included a special report on breast cancer, one portion of which featured pictures of topless breast cancer survivors showing how they had dealt with the aftermath of mastectomies. In addition, the magazine included a full-page advertisement for a sex technique improvement video series. The ad featured pictures of scantily clad couples embracing. The BBC TV's breakfast program has apologized after one of its guests used a four-letter word during a studio discussion. The incident came during a chat about child-rearing and whether parents were giving in too easily to their youngsters' demands. The word was used by newspaper columnist Deborah Orr as she talked about the problems of children swearing. Dateline Belfast, Northern Ireland, a Catholic priest who witnessed Irish Republican Army disarmament, an act supposed to build Protestant support for Northern Ireland's peace process, apologized this week for comparing the province's Protestant community to the Nazis. Blonde beauty Paris Hilton decided to write a sorry note to her ex-best friend Nicole Richie in order to put an end to the petty row between them. Mutual friends persuaded her to put an end to their fallout and try to become pals again. Man, I sure hope so. I haven't been the same. And Minnesota Vikings owner Ziggy Wilf apologized on behalf of the organization today for his player's role in an alleged sex party at the beginning of the month on 2 chartered boats on Lake Minnetonka. He insisted he will dole out punishments for those involved, with fines and or suspensions. There will be no exceptions for players involved. You got to keep football players off those sex boats. The Apology of the Week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Speaking of Catholic clergy, well, we were there a moment ago in the apologies. The Archdiocese of Los Angeles this week published summaries of confidential files on 126 clergymen accused of sexually abusing children, chronicling its failure for decades to act on complaints from parents, notify police, or warn parishioners in the nation's largest Roman Catholic diocese. What we have here is a church that is embarrassed, that is contrite, that is ashamed of what happened in the past, and is committed to reforming it to the extent that it's humanly possible to do so. That statement from the Archdiocese's attorney. The summaries do not contain anything close to the level of graphic detail that Catholic dioceses in Boston, Philadelphia, and other cities have been forced to provide as a result of grand jury investigations. The Archdiocese neglected or decided not to report any of these incidents to legal authorities, opting instead to transfer the errant priests to other jurisdictions and to give them therapy.
I'll not surrender my illusion. pretty little hand covers up her mouth when she yawns. Wake me up, I must be dreaming that the sweet one only rested in my arms. Sleepy kisses.
Ladies and gentlemen, just one dog trainer correction this week for your listening pleasure. An article about confirmations of avian flu in Turkey and Romania said the two countries border each other. They do not. Los Angeles dog trainer correction for you. That's going to conclude this edition of the show. The program returns. They could border each other. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz shortwave, around the world at two different locations on your computer whenever you want it via the internet, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available at channel 136 at Sirius Satellite Radio, a free download at www.audible.com/theshow, and a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like Romania and Turkey sharing a border, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Already, thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks. Can't get that Purim song out of my head, though. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.